Warning! This program contains strong adult language, violence, and brief nudity. It's everything you're looking for. Live from the Sims Tower in the Robinson Auto Group studio, we are AM 1600 WKKX.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Whispers Radio here on AM 1600 WKKX, the Valley's Watchdog, and UPRN, the UFO Paranormal Radio Network. It is 6:07 p.m.
72 degrees.
This is a great winter, let me tell you.
I know. This is still technically. I went out yesterday to put bread out on the back deck for the birds.
Yeah.
And I had two pots that we had put tulip bulbs in last year, and they never really bloomed.
Yeah.
I think they were traumatized by moving them. And these pots, I'd moved them closer to the house, and I look at them, they have 6-inch leaves on them already. So I moved them into the sun and weeded the pots, and yeah, we've got tulips ready,
yeah,
ready to bloom.
We've had a great great winter. I see I'm already messing it up, which is really good. I know my dad's listening. Usually every year I clean off around the pool and hide all the stuff that's supposed to be around the pool, hide it under the little gazebo thing, and I never did it this year because I'm a horrible son. But it never really snowed, so God's got my back. And I hope he doesn't beat me for mentioning it. Give us a call, 304-214-1600. If you're out of the area, 1-866-514-1600. That's toll-free. I'm Jordan Klein. She's Sarah Howard. And you're not on. Now are you?
Hello.
There you are. And the lovely Lola Miller, who is trying to get our guest on the phone.
Yes.
I was listening. I think we've had him on before, back in 2009. And I was listening. It's when I'd say, the lovely Lola, and you go, I don't know if you remember that, but it was nice to hear you giggle. She's not even listening. Yeah, I know. Okay. We are going to talk about some, how do I want to say? It's called the Nephilim. I don't know if you've ever heard of it, but it is a, supposedly when the angels fell from heaven.
Yes.
They
fornicated
is a good word, with people, and their offspring were called the Nephilim. It's in Genesis. Mm-hmm. Well, the Nephilim are supposed to be like Goliath, you know, that's the one I know. That's who I've heard it to be in terms of. Remember Patrick Heron?
Yeah.
When we had him from Ireland?
Uh-huh.
That's what he talked about, the Nephilim. So we're supposed to be talking to that. I think Scott is referencing them to extraterrestrial origins. Did we not get him?
No.
Well, that's great. Well, give us a call, 304-214-1600, out of the area, 1-866-514-1600.
Okay, let's talk a little Walking Dead.
Listen,
no, don't
listen.
Say a word.
Aww, oh, no.
We missed the finale.
Oh, Lola, I love that face. That was great.
Oh, I made it an absolute point to watch it last night. So did John. So everyone could have intelligent conversations about it today because, wow.
Is it wow?
Wow.
Listen, Jordan, we're going to grill our steaks tonight and we're going to watch it.
Now, listen. Did it leave it open for another season?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, because I know when we got our tattoos done, Corey, the guy who was tattooing us, said that he had read that they were kind of nixing it after this.
No. Oh, no.
Good.
No, and according to spoilers, this has been in the works. There's the whole next season is planned out.
Really?
Already. So I kind of... No.
We have a little social experiment going.
Yes, and it's not working so well. get over here and sit down. We both have our puppies in here. And
Bones.
Go get
go. Him. Yeah, Bones is over here wanting to play with me, and Gretchen's being extremely jealous. It's not...
All right, good. So Walking Dead. Can you give us any hints of stuff that's not going to give it away?
No.
Because I know...
Okay, more people from the farm die.
Oh, man.
And let me see.
See, I was kind of heartbroken that Dale died.
Oh,
Well, this is, I bet this is our guest. I'm hoping. Let me see. What else can I tell you that?
I cried a little bit when Dale died. I'm not going to lie.
Do you remember? Oh, you haven't seen it. I think, is that our guest? I think the government is trying to herd them. And I love the fact that they're referring to the walkers now as herds.
Really?
Yes.
And there's like, I don't know, about 1,000, but hundreds start. I can tell you this.
Okay.
It starts in probably Atlanta. I don't know. It's supposed to be, some big city. It's got to be Atlanta. And a helicopter goes over, and they all start following the helicopter.
Oh.
And I think John and I were talking. This won't give anything away. That they're trying to herd them to one place, and then they'll napalm them.
Yeah. See, because I remember they were setting it up that during the winter they'd all probably die out. So
And do you remember?
Oh, fool.
Yes. Because you got to remember, the creator said he has no allegiance to any character. He will kill anybody and everybody off. Just like he killed Dale.
Yep.
And then he kills Shane.
Really?
What?
You've missed more than the finale.
We didn't get to watch.
We didn't watch the end of the last episode. Oh, okay. We're done with this. I'm throwing something at you.
I thought you saw that.
Stop.
Okay, our guest.
Oh, I am so sorry. That's like, I hate it when people tell me the end of a book or a movie. I'm sorry.
But on the chat room, somebody says,
you are going to be. Well, so now you've got 2 hours to watch.
Yeah.
You will be shocked. I'm
calling you in the middle of the night. I know that's like the season of Dexter where his wife, I called my brother-in-law. It was like 5 o'clock in the morning. I'm like, what?
Oh, I know. With Sons of Anarchy too. There, John's gotten strange texts late at night.
Jordan's brother just gave us all 3 of the seasons of Sons of Anarchy, so we're supposed to watch those.
Yeah. Sons is one of the best shows. Now, when they're in Ireland, that season was, okay. But I love it now that they're back home.
Well, so you ruined it for me.
Thanks.
I'm joking.
I thought you knew
I'm joking.
That.
I don't know anything about it.
We've not seen anything.
There's a motorcycle on the cover. I know that much.
Yeah.
All right, our guest.
These people that are so sadly lacking in their educations.
Right.
Falling Skies is about to come back, too.
Which is?
Not a clue.
Oh, you're kidding. That's one where the aliens come and there's little pockets of humanity and they're oh, man.
What channel is that on?
Not AMC.
See, AMC's got the best.
I know.
Mm-hmm.
Shoot. It's on one of the ones that I watch all the time. It's in my favorites, so I just... But they've started reruns, from last season, so I know that's coming. And do you watch Justified?
We don't have TV.
I know, but that's...
We find it online.
You can find Justified online. Oh, that's about Harlan County, Kentucky. I loves me some Justified. Raylan, he's the coolest sheriff.
You're a mess.
I know it. I need a life. Oh, my gosh.
Our guest, Mr. Scott Roberts, he is the author of the book, The Rise and Fall of the Nephilim, The Untold Story of Fallen Angels, Giants on the Earth, and Their Extraterrestrial Origins. Scott, are you with us?
I am. And what? Shane is dead?
Right?
No, I'm kidding.
Oh.
I saw that one.
Oh.
I didn't see last night's, though.
All right, well, you can't give anything away, then.
All right.
It is so good.
That show, I got to tell you, that's a riveting show. It's one of those shows where you watch that and you go, I hate this show.
I know.
So... But I love the show, frankly.
I so want to be an extra on there and be a zombie. I walk around practicing.
I'd be the one that they cut the half their body off and just dragging yourself.
I know. I want to be one.
Jeez. You see what I'm stuck here with, Scott?
You love us and you know it.
You are also the founder and publisher of Intrepid Magazine. And
yes.
Editor-in-chief of Sci-Fi's Ghost Hunters magazines and Taps Pair magazine. You still do
that? I used to be with Taps, no longer.
Okay.
As
So you're quite right. Now, okay. I got to try to remember this. Because we had a Scott Roberts on back in 2009, and I'm thinking it's you.
Maybe.
Were you working on a TV show, trying to work on a TV show?
Yes, we were. We were. We had a little thing we were working on called Dead Reckoning.
Yep, that's the one.
All right.
Yeah, because I did some research. I'm like, I know I had this guy on before.
Oh, boy. I don't even remember.
Yeah, well.
My old age.
It was July of 2009, so it was
quite a while ago. Oh, and don't think he just plucked that out of his memory. He went back and looked.
Oh, I definitely looked it back on the website. I was like, this name is so familiar. I know this. And then your picture's on the back of the book, and I'm like, I know I friended him on MySpace or something.
Yeah, probably. Sorry, I don't remember. I'm just, I'm like one of the, Einstein said, I never bother to remember anything I can look up. So I figure I'm not forgetful. I'm just the genius.
There you see. So. I'm going to use that.
All right.
This book. Let's talk about this book because you're taking. Now you went to seminary and theology school.
I did.
And then you left that for a career. But you have this ingrained in you, so you know like the biblical references, and throughout your book, you're throwing out the biblical references of what you're talking about. But you also have a feel that say, they have extraterrestrial origins.
Yes.
So let's talk about that.
All right. Well, first of all, you've got this wild story in Genesis. And it's funny, we go to church or we grew up in church or synagogue, for me, church, and you hear all these stories and you don't think twice about them. You don't think twice about, the parting of the Red Sea, the world was flooded and all these animals on an ark, and you think of all these miraculous stories, and then we hear... you hear about aliens. Oh, aliens don't exist. Come on, I think that was the big thing that I found that was not so hypocritical, but lacking.
How can you stretch your mind in one area and not the other?
Right. Okay. Right. Oh, because one is God. Oh, okay. Well, now here's the viewpoint I took was this: is that we've got this biblical story, but is there more to that biblical story? And basically what the book does is this. It says if you can and I don't want to offend anybody's religious sensibilities or their spiritualities, but if you separate yourself and, in a sense, get out of the box of religion for a minute, no matter what faith you are, look at the Hebrew version, which is in Genesis. Let's call it that. People go, the Hebrew version? No, I'm not saying anything by that. I'm saying I've taken myself out of the box for the purpose of study. And you look at that, and then you start comparing it to about 600 different cultures that have the same story of a flood. And linked to that story of the flood is always spirit beings or non-human entities that interbreed with humans, create a hybrid race, and some superior being or God wants to wipe them out. And that's where the flood story fits in. Uh-huh. Only different cast of characters, different events, slightly different things. But when you step back, you see all these different cultures have these stories, and so you say, wait a minute, which one of these stories is true? Or is there just a common thread running through all of them, and they've all got their different versions of the event? Which one happened first? And there's no way to know. And this is how you can take an event like that and say, yes, there is a religious or faith story, which is when science or archaeology or anthropology poo-poos the spiritual aspect sometimes and wants to just get down to the facts. The fact is that there was a huge event that happened to the human race, and it's verified, not because you can bring it into the laboratory and apply the scientific method and study it that way. You can't bring a non-human entity and a human woman into a lab and start procreating, we want to study this. You can't do that scientifically, but what you can do is say there's a sort of scientific methodology in play saying that something happened because every culture has talked about it in their own different version. And what it comes down to for me is this. It does not cancel out the existence of God for me. I think ancient alien theory and biblical theory or spiritual and religious theory can also exist. What you've got are beings that did something, changed humanity, and you can see it in every different culture and every different religion.
Now, this is, how do I want to say, I was talking with a chiropractor this morning, Jeff Hefner. You love him, Lola. And I was telling him about how the theory, I guess, of the fallen angels kind of goes parallel with, like, the Greek gods. You know, when you talk about the fallen angels, you know, and then you talk about these gods that are walking the earth, fornicating with the women. Now, do you have any kind of ideas, I guess, parallel to that?
I do. As a matter of fact, there's one of the old trains of thought theologically, at least to the Genesis story. It says right there in the book of Genesis, and the sons of God came down and intermingled with the daughters of men and had children by them. And they were known as the Nephilim, the heroes of old and the men of renown. And that's really all it says in Genesis. You go, wow, that's a great hint at a story. What's here? You go to one of the apocryphal books, which was booted out of the Bible by one of Constantine's councils in the 300s, but you go to the book of Enoch, and you see the whole story blown out into chapter after chapter after chapter, detailing it. And what you've got is the old train of thought in theology was that these are fallen angels who came down and intermingled with women. But it never uses the Hebrew term for angel in any of those old Hebrew texts. And where you might say, yeah, the Bible's stories and so on, there is a certain logic about the way those stories are told, even biblically. And when a word is not even apparent in the text at all, you say there's something missing here. Maybe they aren't angels at all. Well, what I did find is this. I took that story of the Nephilim, which is really the preamble to the flood story, which was never taught when I was a kid in Sunday school. You never learned about any kind of beings coming down and impregnating human women in connection to the flood.
They skipped that in Sunday school.
They skipped that for some reason. There's no
scares kindergartners
for a non-human entity having sex with a woman.
Lola?
Well, I don't ever remember hearing anything in connection with the flood like that. How did that fit into then, you know, morph into the flood story?
Well, it's actually the flood starts in Genesis chapter 6. I can't remember which verse. I think it's like verse 8. But the first couple of verses are kind of introducing chapter 6. It talks about the Nephilim for four or five verses, then a couple of verses in between about the lifespan of humanity, and then it jumps right into Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord and so on. And what you've got here in the flood story is, what did we learn about the flood when we were kids? And I will get to, by the way, that whole question about the pantheon of gods. What did you hear about the flood? You heard that Noah was chosen because he was the only righteous man, because God was going to destroy the earth because of the wickedness of mankind. He was going to use a flood, and we know the whole story basically like that.
Right.
We never connect the Nephilim to that. But what happens in the Hebrew text when you start digging into the language in which it was written, you find this story, and I'll just boil it down to the brass tacks, is that there were beings from heaven, if you will, or from the heavens, who came down, bred with human women, created a hybrid race, and God was going to destroy that race by a watery flood, and that Noah wasn't the only righteous man, as it reads in the Hebrew. He was the only pure-blooded man, he and his family left. And it even says in the English, it says, he was pure in all his generations. Now, I never quite understood what that meant until I studied this out. Now, you'll have to forgive me. I office at home, so I have small children running
around.
That's
okay.
That's okay. We have dogs trying to eat each other.
Yes.
All right.
They're not playing well together.
And so what you've got is this story of Noah was the man that was called not pure, or I'm sorry, not righteous, but pure-blooded. And I thought, what is this pure-blooded thing all about? It said that he was chosen because he was pure-blooded and pure in all his generations back to Adam. Then you start doing the genealogies. You look at all those boring genealogies in the Old Testament, and it starts supporting this case. All of a sudden you see, wait a minute, these genealogies weren't there just for nothing. They were there to establish that there was a pure human bloodline versus a non-pure human bloodline.
Huh.
And it goes all the way back to the Garden of Eden, where you have, remember the Garden of Eden story? You've got Adam and Eve, and you've got the snake comes into the garden, the serpent, and he tempts Eve, and Eve takes and eats of the fruit and likes it and gives it to Adam. Poof, suddenly, oh, they're naked. And God comes looking for them, and we're hiding, we're naked. Well, who told you we're naked? Well, the woman gave me this thing, and the woman's like, oh, the snake gave me this. And God curses everybody. And what happens right there in the garden, you see that the first messianic prophecy, the prophecy of a Messiah. Now, this is all from the Hebrew perspective. This is their version of this story and why it happened.
Okay.
So you've got God cursing them and saying there will be a Messiah. It's hidden in the text that says, and you will bruise his heel, but he will crush your head. That's a messianic prophecy. The Hebrew sense of the word Messiah always meant kinsman redeemer. That's why, like, if you grew up in church and at Christmas time you heard, you know, when Jesus was born, he was one of us. There was a big thing about that in the Hebrew theology, that he was one of us. It was very important. He had to be born of pure human blood. And the serpent created a line with Eve that was the impure blood. Eve had twins, Cain and Abel. According to there's this whole passage about Eve and the serpent in the garden and Adam, it's not about eating forbidden fruit and committing some act of disobedience. It is all about a sexual encounter where Eve bears the son of the serpent and she bears the son of Adam in her womb in twin boys. And the way this is borne out is, again, go again once again to all these different cultures.
You went dirty with it.
Oh, man, it's a naughty story. And never, by the way, in the text, who were we taught in Sunday school? Who was the snake in the garden? Who was that?
The devil.
The devil. Do you know that the term Lucifer, the name Lucifer, Satan, the devil, never appears in the text anywhere? That's attributed thousands of years later. What the text says is that the serpent, he was called Nakosh. That's the word used for serpent in the text. And Nakosh means, by definition, this: trickster, bringer of knowledge, illuminator, bright shining one. That is who Nakosh was.
Okay.
Now, Nakosh came down, and this coincides with, again, every other religious cultural story. There is always some trickster character that comes in, brings forbidden knowledge, and at the same time impregnates either the woman of the creation couple or the daughter of the woman of the creation couple. It's always in the story, and there's always multiple births attached to it in all these different cultures. So what you have going on with the Adam and Eve story is this. You boil it again down to the brass tacks. What happened was this. Nakosh, the bright shining one, he comes in, has sex with Eve. Seduces Eve. That's what the temptations are. Seduction is the word in the Hebrew. All the terms in there. She took, she ate, she gave to Adam, brought Adam into the picture. And what happens is she conceives twins. And this is borne out all the way through the Old Testament. When you start reading the theology that is behind the Hebrew kinsman redeemer, the Messiah, it's all about a tainted bloodline and a pure bloodline, and the Messiah had to hail from the pure bloodline. So you've got it all through the genealogies, and you get up to Noah and the Ark story. And by the way, I got to tell you, my 2-year-old son is following me around with his little play lawnmower, and I am walking everywhere I can to get away from him. He's falling there, like, Dad, and nailing my feet with it. And I'm about ready to pick it up and throw it across the yard, but that would just sound hostile over the phone. But that's the noise.
That's okay. We've had way worse. We had a guy answer another phone on there. He's like, "Hey, hold on a second, guys. Hello." Like, you put us on hold.
So what you've got having happened here is when you get to Noah, this is why when God is going to destroy this hybrid race that was created through the mixing of the sons of God, or in the Hebrew they're called the Bene HaElohim, who come down, interbreed with the daughters of men and have children by them, he's going to destroy this race. And he's going to preserve the race in the one pure-blooded human family that is left. And he chooses Noah to do that. Then you get all the way down the line. It's very interesting. You follow these genealogies in the Old Testament. Here's the case, and here's how you establish that this is so. You can't just look at a single scripture without comparing it to the rest of their theology. You trace these genealogies. They're always traced through the firstborn son. That was the Hebrew tradition. Well, you get down to King David. They trace his lineage back through his genealogies all the way back to Adam, but they don't trace him through the firstborn son. Why is that? because the firstborn son wasn't of pure human blood, because the prophecies after the time of David started changing about the kinsman, redeemer, and the Messiah. They had to be, the Messiah was now going to come from the line of David. And this is why he was born in Bethlehem, in the city of David, and so on. And then when Mary, when they get to the New Testament, they trace Mary, the mother of Jesus, her lineage, all the way back to David, because they have to establish that the mother of Jesus is of the line of David to fulfill the prophecies. But then they trace it again back to Adam, but not through the firstborn Cain. They trace it through the lesser born. Why is that? Because the firstborn Cain was the son of Nakash and Eve, and he introduced the impure human bloodline. And way back in the garden, when God's cursing everybody, he looks at the serpent and the woman, and he says, and there will be enmity or constant conflict between the seed of the serpent and the seed of the woman or the seed of humankind. And that enmity is there's going to be constant conflict because they are two separate bloodlines. And the bloodline and the whole issue of blood and the whole issue of sexual prohibition all the way through the Levitical law in the Old Testament, all of these things start to make a huge amount of sense when you step back from them and go, wait a minute. The whole picture is, it's telling you, in the Old Testament, God created humans. Somebody came and tainted the human bloodline right at the get-go, right at the beginning, right out the starting gate. Smack, Eve has sex with Nakash and taints the human bloodline forever. And this is who the Nephilim are. Then it says God's going to wipe them out in the flood.
Here's a question. Let me interrupt you real quick. There's also, I've heard stories... how do I want to explain? Lilith. Lilith was said to be the first wife of Adam. Now, there's not really an account in, you know, our Bible, but...
Right.
But, you know, there is, like...
There are stories of Lilith. You won't find it in the book of Genesis. It's omitted there, strangely. You have a hint that there was an earlier creation, a hint that there was a first wife. I mean, just ever so delicately encoded in there, but for some reason left out. But Lilith was the first wife of Adam. As a matter of fact, there are some Hebrew scholars that believe Lilith was the serpent. But they try to tie that all together, too. Well, Lilith, according to Scripture, it talks about God creating man and woman, and they were perfect. But then it goes back and it says, and then God took the rib from Adam and formed the woman out of Adam's rib. And that was a theology that was behind putting together that story. And Lilith was never mentioned by name because whoever wrote the book of Genesis didn't think it was important to pass that little tidbit of information along. But you will find it in other Jewish writings. You'll find it in Jewish traditional writings, the Mishnah. You'll find it, I don't think it's in the book of Enoch, but it's in some of the other writings that are there that Adam had a first wife. You also find it in creation itself. Genesis 1:1, what does it say? And in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, period. Empirical statement in the Hebrew, a perfect creation. Verse 2, and the earth was without form and void, or literally rendered without form and void, and the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters, and so on. And we have what that is, that there are many. I had a seminary professor who got in trouble for teaching this once, because I was in a very conservative, fundamentalist Baptist setting, and, oh, we don't teach that here. But he had what he called the gap theory.
Are you talking like the pre-adamant? Period.
Yes, which fits into the whole religious concept or spiritual concept, like the Indian Yugas, where they talk about the earth has been created and recreated possibly millions of times over billions of years.
Because they say that God wouldn't make something formless and void.
That's right.
I sat under Pastor Paul Baugus, actually sat with me and talked about for hours on this topic.
I got to tell you, though, when people attribute things to God, God wouldn't do that or he couldn't do that. You know what? I find lots of things breaking with what we believe to be the attributes and character of God. We always think of God as being omniscient, all-present, all-knowing, and perhaps he is all those things. But at the same time, he was a guy that could get pissed off. He was a guy that you got Moses changing God's mind at one point. After the whole golden calf scene, you've got God in the mountaintop and with Moses, and Moses is pleading for the people, and God says, I'm going to wipe these people out. I'm so sick of them. They do this and they do that. And says, God, you can't. And he says to Moses, he says, I'm going to wipe them out and restart the whole thing in you. And meaning the whole promise to Abraham that your seed on the earth will be like the stars in the heaven. And Moses, it says to God, God, you can't do that, because if you do that, you would be going back on your word. And that's not who God is. And it says right after Moses does that, it says, and God repented of the evil he was going to do. And you had God's mind being changed by Moses, which brings in a whole thing. In my book, I've got a whole chapter on Moses, because I was writing about why would he have written about the Nephilim? Who was he to this story? Why did he say things the way he did? And I took it all the way back, and I dated Moses to the biblical passages and give you rock-solid dates as to when he lived, who the pharaohs were around him, which are never mentioned by name in Moses' writings.
Yeah.
And I establish who he is, but I also say this, and this is a side topic. I'm going to write about this one of these days in greater length, but Moses, I believe, was establishing himself as the pharaoh god of Israel. I believe he was raised and groomed to be the pharaoh of Egypt, and that's what he learned for the first 40 years of his life. And when he stepped out and killed that Egyptian taskmaster who was beating a Hebrew slave, it wasn't because, oh, he cares about his people. It said he was there with his entourage, and he killed this guy. And then it's found out, and it says, and Pharaoh sought to take his life, and he ran for fear of having his life taken. Well, this is the guy, if you do the historical study, he was in rivalry for the throne. Both of their stepmother was on the throne at the time, and Moses was a rival for that throne. So when he was 40, make no mistake, Moses was pure Egyptian. He was. It's like me saying, I was born in Ohio, but I moved to Minneapolis when I was a year old, and I lived in Minneapolis for 40 years. Am I a Ohioan or am I a Minnesotan? Well, I'm Ohioan by birth.
So I think the Disney movie, that portrayed it very well, that he was very Egyptian until that point.
And they've got it all wrong. The whole Charlton Heston movie and that, according to the Bible, Moses was 80 years old at the time of the Exodus. When he fled Egypt, he was gone for 40 years. And he married the daughter of the high priestess in Midian. Or the high priest in Midian. It wasn't even the Hebrew religion. He was into something completely different. He came back to Egypt. And you remember the scene where he's coming to Pharaoh, the whole let my people go scenario and all the 10 plagues. It says at one point, it says that when Moses decreed one of these plagues, it says, and Pharaoh and his entourage were terrified of Moses. And Moses turned on his heel in a rage and left. I mean, he had power over them. Why? Because I think they recognized who this guy was from the past history. And Moses was no slouch. He was a guy that was groomed to be the Pharaoh. And he came back and became the Pharaoh god of Israel. As a matter of fact, there are places where, and I just think this is interesting, it gives you a whole perspective on how the Bible was written about any of these kinds of stories. You show Moses wrote the first 5 books of the Bible. I don't think there's much reason to doubt it. It's like saying Homer wrote the Iliad and the Odyssey.
Yeah.
Who was Homer? He didn't even really exist. Well, there's a lot of evidence extra-biblical that Moses existed, and there's too many things about Moses to say he was not a historical character. But Moses was establishing his leadership over Israel when he led them out of Egypt. And what did he do? There are places where it says, and Moses pitched his tent outside the camp, and God would descend on his tent in a cloud and speak to Moses, and Moses talked to God face to face as a man talked to his friend. Then 9 verses later in the very same chapter in the book of Exodus, it says, and God said, no man can see my face and live. And this is 9 verses apart in one chapter. Well, is that a contradiction? No, I believe Moses wrote that on purpose. He authored it. What was he saying? No man can see God and live, but I talk to God face to face like a man talks to his friend. What was he saying there? I'm more than a man. I am the Pharaoh God of Israel. I am not all man. And as a matter of fact, that was the sin recorded later by a later scribe that said Moses was died and couldn't go into the land of promise. It was because he kept equating himself with God. So this is who this guy was. I think Moses was a, and I think you can say this word on the radio, I think he was an arrogant bastard. And that's because he was a monarch. He was a ruler in the making. And we forget, and we take these little tidbits of history out of context. Same thing with the Nephilim story. You got to look at the story and dig out and parse down the facts and say, what does it say here? What's encoded? What is the big picture when you step back from it? And then all you're left with, when you figure that all out, you got this story about the Nephilim. You figured out who they were. They're the sons of God, the Bene HaElohim. Enoch refers to them as the Watchers, came down and impregnated human women.
Now, I remember reading in Enoch about the Watchers.
Oh, yeah. And he doesn't use the term angels again. He talks about the Watchers, the Bene HaElohim. And this is one thing I've got to establish for you, who these people were that came down and intermingled with the daughters of humans. Back in Genesis, when we're talking about the serpent character, Nakosh, he's defined, remember, as the bringer of knowledge and the bright shining one. He's called the Illuminator. You go to Psalm 82, and this is one of the references, scant references in the Old Testament, to a group called the Divine Council. And it's this group in the heavens. They say in heaven. Try to get the picture of the gates of gold and the pearly streets and all this.
Uh-huh.
But in heaven, in the heavenlies, there was the Divine Council. And God is chewing them out for something in Psalm 82. He's passing judgment on them. Doesn't say what for, but he's really angry. And the name for God used in that passage in Psalm 82 is the word Elohim. Now, Elohim is one of many names used for God in the Old Testament, but the one that's used the most. It's used almost 3,000 times in the Old Testament to describe God, Elohim. Now, El being the name of God, E-L, ancient etymology of Hebrew, it's the name for God, El, and Him in the Hebrew language, the ancient Hebrew language, the Him was a plural suffix put on the end of a word to pluralize it. So you've got Elohim. Elohim literally being translated, the name for God used almost 3,000 times in the Old Testament, means literally God of many gods or God among many gods. And that threw me for a minute. And then you go to Psalm 82, and here's what it says. I will interchange the word Elohim where it fits into the text. It says, and God, Elohim, stood, singular act, in the midst of the Elohim, plural. You can't stand in the midst of a singularity. And he, singular, said to them, plural, you are all Elohim, gods among many gods, the bright, shining princes of heaven. He calls them, but I could strip you of your immortality and you will die like men. He goes on to pass judgment of them, over them. Now, God is a plurality. If I can, I don't want to offend anybody's sensibilities again, religiously speaking, but the Bible does not teach monotheism. The Bible teaches that God was perhaps the king of the gods or perhaps over the gods.
Well, they talk about the Trinity.
That's the thing. There is never a triune reference in the Old Testament either. As a matter of fact, the Trinity didn't exist until New Testament times. Oh, God the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. You don't have that ever being talked about in the Old Testament. And it never spells out that it's only three. It says God of many gods or among many gods, and then he calls the group of the Divine Council, he calls them Elohim, the plural form of Elohim. Now, by the way, Elohim is like our English word for deer. I can say, I see a deer in my front yard, singular. I see a herd of deer in my backyard, or walkers, in my backyard, plural. And this is what Elohim was. It could be used singularly or plurally, depending on the context of the passage. Well, he's passing judgment on not just two other guys. He's passing judgment on the Divine Council. And now take the definition that he's using there. He calls them the bright, shining princes of heaven. Go all the way back to the Garden of Eden. Nakosh, the serpent character, impregnates Eve. Nakosh, the bringer of knowledge, the illuminator, the bright, shining one. You've got Nakosh is somebody who was a member of the Divine Council. Now, if he was Lucifer, They don't say it ever in the text. But he was a member of this divine council.
All right, Lola's got a question.
Well, it's just, I am not by any stretch of the imagination an authority on the Bible or any, but I did go to one class at Temple, and, you know, she was saying so much depended, A, on how it was translated, and B, you have to go back to when it was actually written down, the first time it was written, not the stories that had been told, but the actual writing. And then you have further interpretations as the Bible, both, you know, the New Testament and the Old, were translated to be more for the, not masses, but, you know, you had all those priests and monks that were doing this translating too. So when you start really thinking about all those things and the original translations from, I don't even know that a lot of it may have been in Hebrew. It may have been in Egyptian or some other,
Greek.
You know. Yeah,
there's a bulk of the Old Testament was written in Hebrew with bits and pieces of Aramaic, but it was overall it was Hebrew.
Well, it fascinates me when you stop and you go back and you really do the translations of the words. And like you said, looking at it in the context.
And that's the whole thing. When you look at any of these passages, you can read it in English and get one story.
Yeah.
But when you look at it and start going back to the Hebrew, for three things I say you always got to look at. First of all, context. Who was it being written to?
Mm-hmm.
Message. Why was it being written to those people in that context? And three, language. And when you get all three of those things together, you will find many times a very different interpretation than the way we read it in English.
That's like if you get into the New Testament, the letters. You know,
yes.
You got to look at who the people of Corinth were, you know, when you're reading about Corinthians.
And then you look at the Greek language. It was most of the New Testament was other than a few sections in Aramaic that Jesus spoke. The whole New Testament was written in Koine Greek. Koine Greek was the result of the world being Hellenized under Alexander the Great, the Hellenization of the Middle Eastern world. And they spoke in Koine Greek. It was one of the most logical languages. It was the language of commerce. Even if you grew up in Jerusalem, in Israel, in Judea, if you were a tradesman, you spoke Koine Greek because Koine Greek was the language, the street language, the street Greek that was used in trade. And that's what the New Testament was written in, and it was an incredibly logical language. And the Greek, you might have a passage that read, I'm just going to make this up. You have a passage that might say, and it was a gloomy day in Jerusalem. But in the Greek, our English for gloomy might translate out gloomy, but in the Greek it might have meant that it was an extremely melancholy day with an overcast sky. You know, the Greek language was so meticulously logical that it would spell it that way in Greek, but it only could translate to one word in the English. It's like the word for baptize. Baptize in the Greek, the Koine Greek, baptism, it doesn't translate baptism. That's a transliteration of the word from Greek letters to English letters. What baptism means is immersion. That's the word. That's why when you have the Anabaptists come into play, they're saying you can't sprinkle a baby, you can't baptize somebody by touching water to their forehead, because the word in the Greek means immerse.
Yeah, you got to dunk them.
And that's take all theology out of that, or whatever your theological point of view. The language is implicit. And it's like the reason they used baptized, they transliterated the word because of the politics of the day when they were translating these things. The politics were there was a certain way baptism was done, and you could get burned at the stake for saying the wrong thing theologically according to the church or according to whatever country was operating under that church's rules. And so they just, you know what, that means immersion. We could get dunked in, we could get burned at the stake. This is translated into English with letters, baptizo. And it became baptized in the English when it means immerse. So those are the linguistics of the Bible. When you start digging into this stuff, you find different meanings.
Yeah, I want to catch you real quick. We got about 5 minutes left, right, Lola?
Yeah.
Okay. I want to hit one of my favorite stories in the Bible is David and Goliath. Absolute favorite. And I've heard several times Goliath being referenced as a Nephilim.
As a matter of fact, the Bible calls him that. And I didn't know this either for many years, even though I went through seminary. I didn't learn this all through seminary. Goliath had three brothers. And they were Goliath and his three brothers. They were called, in a later place in the Old Testament, they are called the children of Anak, the sons of the Nephilim. And David, by the way, we've got the story of him killing Goliath, but we don't. Did you ever hear the stories about where he hunted down the rest of the brothers when he became king and as he was a mighty man of valor after that? That's what he did. He and his warriors hunted down Goliath's three other brothers and killed them all. But you don't see that. But in this little passage, by the way, fascinating story. I love history, and I love the way it all works. You've got the little valley of Elah in Israel, and you can visit it today. It's a shallow little rocky valley with hills, sloping hills on either side.
I got a pastor in the chat room right now. He said Goliath had four brothers. There were five of them altogether.
Sorry, I might have gotten that wrong then. As far as I knew, there were only four of them. I might have missed a fifth one. I mean, that was Buford of Gath. But I don't make fun. I may have misnumbered them. I thought there were only four, and I actually got it in my book as four because I read it as four. But sorry, I might have missed a brother there somewhere.
That's okay.
But it says that Goliath came down from the slope where the Philistines were encamped and yelled across the valley to the armies of Israel, "Send out your champion," blah, blah, blah. We know the story. Well, he did this for 40 days, and I thought it was a pretty interesting story that by the end of the 40th day, you've got Goliath that says, and when Goliath was coming up out of the valley, up the slope toward the army of Israel, taunting him, this is when David comes on the scene delivering food to his brothers. And you've got this for 40 days. You got this champion started off on his side of the valley, and by 40 days later, he's already coming up the other side because nobody would take his challenge. He's taunting them right in their faces. Now, it says he stood 6 cubits in a span. Now, who knows what a cubit is exactly? We've got a general idea. It was roughly the measurement of a man from his elbow to the tips of his fingers. So some men had longer cubits than others.
Always has mattered.
Now, are we talking Goliath's cubits? Because those might be larger.
Cubit envy. it was roughly, you can measure out Goliath as being anywhere from about 9'4" to 10'2", somewhere in that range. And so this is the size of this guy. And there's these claims that he suffered from giantess. Well, he was this big, and the stone sank into his forehead when David slung it, and so on. But it also says that he and his brothers were warriors from the days of their youth, and still a warrior. Anybody who suffers from giantess, once they hit puberty and start maturing, their bones keep growing, getting more brittle and more brittle.
Yeah,
Goliath was a mature male and had giantess, he couldn't be a warrior. He couldn't fight. Some of them can barely walk straight. So you've got this mighty warrior. David takes him out, and I've always found a very interesting point on this. When he kills him with the sling, it says that he cuts off Goliath's head and takes Goliath's head and sword with him to Jerusalem.
And throws it at the king.
Well, here's an interesting thing. He's just a shepherd boy right now. He's been anointed by Samuel, but he's not the king, and he doesn't become the king for several years, and it's 13 years from the time of Goliath and the Valley of Elah is taking his head off that David conquers the city of Salem and renames it Jerusalem. So you can see this was written after that fact.
Yeah.
It says that he took the head and sword with him to Jerusalem. Well, he didn't go there for 13 more years, but he still had this head, and he still had this sword. David kept that thing, I think, and remember, he became the chief captain of the king's bodyguard as a result of killing Goliath,
uh-huh.
And he became a mighty man of valor. And he took that head with him, and I'll bet you got to get into your head. Remember, he was a Middle Eastern monarch in the making in ancient times.
He probably carried it around there with him.
Stuck that thing on a pole, put it up there with his flag, and said, "Yep, David, the slayer of Goliath." And that was what he went into battle with. I'll bet you anything.
Oh, that's an interesting way to look at it. I never...
That was one smelly camel, I can tell you. Gooey. 13 years of carting that puppy around?
Oh, it probably didn't weigh like a sparrow. I'll bet you that thing was heavy from a guy who was almost 10 feet tall.
Well, it wasn't as heavy as
I'm sure
it
lost a little substance over the years. But there you go. So all these stories, have deeper meanings to them. And I believe the story of the Nephilim is a story of race interrupted. It is a story of beings who came in. I believe they were members of the divine council. Now, that is the way the Hebrew Bible tells the story. And I only put it that way to say, separate yourself out and say, I've had my faith challenged a bit at times when I've studied this stuff out, because I said, wait, if all the other cultures have this same story with different casts of characters and different elements to the story, but they all tell the same basic thread, and they're thousands of years apart, but some of them thousands of years ago, what do you got here when you're seeing that this story is being told in all these cultures? Some of them, the Sumerian version of the tale, talks about these beings and the stuff that happened 3,000 years before Moses wrote the book of Genesis. So you're saying, did these events, were they already known? And people just plug, oh, I know it was Adam and Eve, but I'm just going to plug my own character's name on it because, you know, I don't like Adam and Eve. I want to call them something else.
Yeah.
You know, they had their own versions of the tales. And so something huge happened to humanity.
Our listeners, how can they get your book and how can they get in touch with you? Do you have a website?
I do. I have, as you mentioned, I'm the publisher of Intrepid Magazine. You can go to intrepidmag.com, and there's a link on there. I think it just takes you to the Amazon site. There's also Barnes & Noble carries it. It should be in all the bookstores now as of the end of February. And so you can get it almost anywhere. And if I can mention quick, when you're at my site, you can click on the Paradigm Symposium link.
Uh-huh.
And if you're into this stuff, you like this talk of ancient aliens and all this, we've got a huge symposium in October up here.
Now, what is a symposium?
It's a hoity-toity word for a conference.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
And we've got Eric Von Daniken, who wrote
Chariots.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
We've got George Norrie coming.
Nice.
Three of the guys from Ancient Aliens, Giorgio Tsoukalos, Phil Coppens, Bill Burns.
Touch Ian his hair.
Connor. Say again?
I said you got to touch his hair when you're there.
Oh yeah, we're talking about all getting wigs or something or doing our hair. So, if you're interested in this stuff, there it is. You can see the magazine there, and the book is available everywhere. The Rise and Fall of the Nephilim. It's through New Page Books. They already had me working on the follow up to this book, which,
good.
As a matter of fact, just today. You wonder why I was late to this call. I spent about the last 48 hours straight getting this proposal in on time.
We understand that.
Brain dead.
Hey, we really enjoy your time. It's interesting conversation. There's people out there that agree with it, disagree with it. If you don't agree with it, then do your own research, prove them wrong.
And that's my biggest message, is don't let anybody tell you what to believe, even the Bible. Go and study it and find out what it says.
Good words. Scott Roberts, The Rise and Fall of the Nephilim, and your book again, Intrepid, or your website, intrepidmag.com.
That's it.
And they can get in touch with you if they want to contact you.
Absolutely. My phone number is, you can call me on this phone. Okay?
There it is.
There it is.
Get on there and give them.
Give them hell.
Give them heaven.
Give them HE double toothpicks.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Scott. And we'll definitely talk to you again and have you definitely when your new book comes out.
Fantastic. I appreciate it.
Awesome. Scott Roberts, thank you very much.
Thanks, guys. Thanks, Jordan. Bye-bye.
Bye. And we're out of time, too.
Yes, we are.
Next week, we're talking about synchronicity of consciousness. It should be pretty neat.
Okay.
Until next week, everybody, don't be afraid. Only believe.